The speech inspired me. I returned to my hotel room and scratched out a letter that I eventually mailed to the Boston Globe. Back in Boston, an editor responded by calling me at my office to request that I write an op-ed piece. I knew that it was a risky thing to do, but I felt strongly about the canal issue, and, looking back, I see that it helped me deal with a growing sense of frustration over my job. Furthermore, I told myself that Torrijos would appreciate it, and I might use it to help Maine get more business in Panama. Colonialism in Panama has no place in 1975, took up nearly half the page opposite the editorials in the September 19, 1975 edition. The article cited three specific reasons for transferring the canal to Panama. First, the present situation is unjust, a good reason for any decision. Second, the existing treaty creates far graver security risks than would result from turning more control over to the Panamanians. I referenced a study conducted by the Interoceanic Canal Commission, which concluded that traffic could be halted for 2 years by a bomb planted, conceivably by one man, in the side of the Gatun Dam, a point General Torrijos himself had publicly emphasized. And third, the present situation is creating serious problems for already troubled United States-Latin American relations. I ended with the following. The best way of assuring the continued and efficient operation of the canal is to help Panamanians gain control over and responsibility for it. In so doing, we could take pride in initiating an action that would reaffirm commitments to the cause of self-determination to which we pledged ourselves 200 years ago. Colonialism was in vogue at the turn of the century, early 1900s, as it had been in 1775. Perhaps ratification of such a treaty can be understood in the context of those times. Today, it is without justification. Colonialism has no place in 1975. We, celebrating our bicentennial, should realize this and act accordingly. Writing that piece was a bold move on my part, especially since I had recently been made a partner at Maine. Partners were expected to avoid the press and certainly to refrain from publishing political diatribes on the editorial pages of New England's most prestigious newspaper. I received through interoffice mail a pile of nasty, mostly anonymous notes stapled to copies of the article. I was certain that I recognized the handwriting on one as that of Charlie Illingworth. My first project manager had been at Maine for over 10 years, compared to less than 5 for me, and was not yet a partner. A fierce skull and crossbones figured prominently on the note, and its message was simple. Is this commie really a partner in our firm? Bruno summoned me to his office and said, "You'll get loads of grief over this. Maine's a pretty conservative place, but I want you to know, I think you're smart. Torrijos will love it. I do hope you're sending him a copy. Good. Well, these jokers here in this office, the ones who think Torrijos is a socialist, really won't give a damn as long as the work flows in." Bruno had been right, as usual. Now it was 1977. Carter was in the White House, and serious canal negotiations were underway. Many of Maine's competitors had taken the wrong side and had been turned out of Panama, but our work had multiplied. And I was sitting in the lobby of the Hotel Panama, having just finished reading an article by Graham Greene in the New York Review of Books. The article, The Country with Five Frontiers, was a gutsy piece that included a discussion of corruption among senior officers in Panama's National Guard. The author pointed out that the general himself admitted to giving many of his staff special privileges, such as superior housing, because if I don't pay them, the CIA will. The clear implication was that the U.S. intelligence community was determined to undermine the wishes of President Carter and, if necessary, would bribe Panama's military chiefs into sabotaging the treaty negotiations. I could not help but wonder if the jackals had begun to circle Torrijos. I had seen, in the People section of Time or Newsweek, a photograph of Torrijos and Green sitting together. The caption indicated that the writer was a special guest who had become a good friend. I wondered how the general felt about this novelist, whom he apparently trusted, writing such a critique. Graham Greene's article raised another question, one that related to that day in 1972 when I had sat across a coffee table from Torrijos. At the time, I had assumed that Torrijos knew the foreign aid game was there to make him rich while shackling his country with debt. I had been sure he knew that the process was based on the assumption that men in power are corruptible, and that his decision not to seek personal benefit, but rather to use foreign aid to truly help his people, would be seen as a threat that might eventually topple the entire system. The world was watching this man. His actions had ramifications that reached far beyond Panama, and would therefore not be taken lightly. I had wondered how the corporatocracy would react if loans made to Panama helped the poor without contributing to impossible debts. Now I wondered whether Torrijos regretted the deal he and I had struck that day, and I wasn't quite sure how I felt about those deals myself. I had stepped back from my EHM role. I had played his game instead of mine, accepting his insistence on honesty in exchange for more contracts. In purely economic terms, it had been a wise business decision for Maine. Nonetheless, it had been inconsistent with what Claudine had instilled in me. It was not advancing the global empire. Had it now unleashed the jackals? I recalled thinking, when I left Torrijos's bungalow that day, that Latin American history is littered with dead heroes. A system based on corrupting public figures does not take kindly to public figures who refuse to be corrupted. Then I thought my eyes were playing tricks. A familiar figure was walking slowly across the lobby. At first, I was so confused that I believed it was Humphrey Bogart, but Bogart was long deceased. Then I recognized the man ambling past me as one of the great figures in modern English literature, author of The Power and the Glory, The Comedians, Our Man in Havana, and the article I had just set down on the table next to me. Graham Greene hesitated a moment, peered around, and headed for the coffee shop. I was tempted to call out or run after him, but I stopped myself. An inner voice said he needed his privacy. Another warned that he would shun me. I picked up the New York Review of Books and was surprised a moment later to discover that I was standing in the doorway to the coffee shop. I had breakfast earlier that morning, and the maitre d' gave me an odd look. I glanced around. Green sat alone at a table near the wall. I pointed to the table beside him. "Over there," I told the maitre d'. "Can I sit there for another breakfast?" I was always a good tipper. The maitre d' smiled knowingly and led me to the table. The novelist was absorbed in his newspaper. I ordered coffee and a croissant with honey. I wanted to discover Green's thoughts about Panama, Torrijos, and the canal affair, but had no idea how to initiate such a conversation. Then he looked up to take a sip from his glass. "Excuse me," I said. He glared at me, or so it seemed. "Yes?" "I hate to intrude, but you are Graham Greene, aren't you?" "Why, yes, indeed." He smiled warmly. "Most people in Panama don't recognize me." I gushed that he was my favorite novelist, and then gave him a brief life history, including my work at Maine and my meetings with Torrijos. He asked if I was the consultant who had written an article about the United States getting out of Panama, in the Boston Globe, if I recall correctly. I was flabbergasted. "A courageous thing to do, given your position," he said. "Won't you join me?" I moved to his table and sat there with him for what must have been an hour and a half. I realized as we chatted how very close to Torrijos he had grown. He spoke of the general at times like a father speaking about his son. "The general," he said, "invited me to write a book about his country. I'm doing just that. This one will be nonfiction, something a bit off the line for me." I asked him why he usually wrote novels instead of nonfiction. "Fiction is safer," he said. "Most of my subject matter is controversial. Vietnam, Haiti, the Mexican Revolution. A lot of publishers would be afraid to publish nonfiction about these matters." He pointed at the New York Review of Books, where it lay on the table I had vacated. "Words like those can cause a great deal of damage." Then he smiled. "Besides, I like to write fiction. It gives me much greater freedom." He looked at me intensely. "The important thing is to write about things that matter, like your Globe article about the canal." His admiration for Torrijos was obvious. It seemed that Panama's head of state could impress a novelist every bit as much as he impressed the poor and dispossessed. Equally obvious was Green's concern for his friend's life. "It's a huge endeavor," he exclaimed, "taking on the giant of the North." He shook his head sadly. "I fear for his safety." Then it was time for him to leave. "Must catch a flight to France," he said, rising slowly and shaking my hand. He peered into my eyes. "Why don't you write a book?" He gave me an encouraging nod. "It's in you. But remember, make it about things that matter." He turned and walked away. Then he stopped and came back a few steps into the restaurant. "Don't worry," he said. "The general will prevail. He'll get the canal back." Torrijos did get it back. In that same year, 1977, he successfully negotiated new treaties with President Carter that transferred the canal zone and the canal itself over to Panamanian control. Then the White House had to convince the U.S. Congress to ratify it. A long and arduous battle ensued. In the final tally, the canal treaty was ratified by a single vote. Conservatives swore revenge. When Graham Greene's nonfiction book, Getting to Know the General, came out many years later, it was dedicated to the friends of my friend Omar Torrijos in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Panama. Chapter 18. Iran's King of Kings. Between 1975 and 1978, I frequently visited Iran. Sometimes I commuted between Latin America or Indonesia and Tehran. The Shah of Shahs, literally King of Kings, his official title, presented a completely different situation from that in other countries where we worked. Iran was oil-rich, and like Saudi Arabia, it did not need to incur debt in order to finance its ambitious list of projects. However, Iran differed significantly from Saudi Arabia in that its large population, though predominantly Middle Eastern and Muslim, was not Arabic. The people were also Shiite, not Sunni. Most Iranian women did not wear veils. In fact, some even sported miniskirts. In addition, the country had a history of political turmoil, both internally and in its relationship with its neighbors. Therefore, we took a different approach. Washington and the business community joined forces to turn the Shah into a symbol of progress. We launched an immense effort to show the world what a strong, democratic friend of U.S. corporate and political interests could accomplish. Never mind his obviously undemocratic title, or the less obvious fact of the CIA-orchestrated coup against the democratically elected premier who preceded him, Washington and its European partners were determined to present the Shah's government as an alternative to those in Iraq, Libya, China, Korea, and other nations where a powerful undercurrent of anti-Americanism was surfacing. To all appearances, the Shah was a progressive friend of the underprivileged. In 1962, he ordered large private landholdings broken up and turned over to peasant owners. The following year, he inaugurated his White Revolution, which involved an extensive agenda for socioeconomic reforms. The power of OPEC grew during the 1970s, and the Shah became an increasingly influential world leader. At the same time, Iran developed one of the most powerful military forces in the Muslim Middle East. Maine was involved in projects that covered most of the country, from tourist areas along the Caspian Sea in the north, to secret military installations overlooking the Strait of Hormuz in the south. Once again, the focus of our work was to forecast regional development potentials, and then to design electrical generating, transmission, and distribution systems that would provide the all-important energy required to fuel the military, industrial, and commercial growth that would realize these forecasts. I visited most of the major regions of Iran at one time or another. I followed the old caravan trail through the desert mountains, from Kerman to Bandar Abbas, and I roamed the ruins of Persepolis, the legendary palace of ancient kings and one of the wonders of the classical world. I toured the country's most famous and spectacular sites, Shiraz, Isfahan, and the magnificent tent city near Persepolis, where the Shah had been crowned. In the process, I developed a genuine love for this land and its complex people. On the surface, Iran seemed to be a model example of Christian-Muslim cooperation. However, I soon learned that tranquil appearances may mask deep resentment. Late one evening in 1977, I returned to my hotel room to find a note shoved under my door. I was shocked to discover that it was signed by a man named Yamin. I had never met him, but he had been described to me during a government briefing as a famous and most subversive radical. In beautifully crafted English script, the note invited me to meet him at a designated restaurant. However, there was a warning. I was to come only if I was interested in exploring a side of Iran that most people, in my position, never saw. I wondered whether Yamin knew what my true position was. I realized that I was taking a big risk. However, I could not resist the temptation to meet this enigmatic figure. My taxi dropped me off in front of a tiny gate in a high wall, so high that I could not see the building behind it. An Iranian woman ushered me in and led me down a corridor illuminated by ornate oil lamps hanging from a low ceiling. At the end of this corridor, we entered a room that dazzled like the interior of a diamond, blinding me with its radiance. When my eyes finally adjusted, I saw that the walls were inlaid with semi-precious stones and mother-of-pearl. The restaurant was lighted by tall white candles protruding from intricately sculpted bronze chandeliers. A tall man with long black hair, wearing a tailored navy blue suit, approached and shook my hand. He introduced himself as Yamin, in an accent that suggested he was an Iranian who had been educated in the British school system, and I was immediately struck by how little he looked like a subversive radical. He directed me past several tables where couples sat quietly eating, to a very private alcove. He assured me that we could talk in complete confidentiality. I had the distinct impression that this restaurant catered to secret rendezvous. Ours, quite possibly, was the only non-amorous one that night. Yamin was very cordial. During our discussion, it became obvious that he thought of me merely as an economic consultant, not as someone with ulterior motives. He explained that he had singled me out because he knew I had been a Peace Corps volunteer, and because he had been told that I took every possible opportunity to get to know his country and to mix with its people. "You are very young compared to most in your profession," he said. "You have a genuine interest in our history and our current problems. You represent our hope." His attitude, as well as the elegant setting, his Western clothes, and the presence of so many others in the restaurant, gave me a certain degree of comfort. I had become accustomed to people befriending me, like Rossi in Java and Fidel in Panama, and I accepted it as a compliment and an opportunity. I knew that I stood out from other Americans because I was in fact infatuated with the places I visited. I have found that people warm to you very quickly if you open your eyes, ears, and heart to their culture. Yamin asked if I knew about the Flowering Desert Project. The Shah believes that our deserts were once fertile plains and lush forests. At least, that's what he claims. During Alexander the Great's reign, according to this theory, vast armies swept across these lands, traveling with millions of goats and sheep. The animals ate all the grass and other vegetation. The disappearance of these plants caused a drought, and eventually the entire region became a desert. Now all we have to do, or so the Shah says, is plant millions upon millions of trees. After that, presto, the rains will return and the deserts will bloom again. Of course, in the process, we will have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. He smiled condescendingly. Companies like yours will reap huge profits. I take it you don't believe in this theory. The desert is a symbol. Turning it green is about much more than agriculture. Several waiters descended upon us with trays of beautifully presented Iranian food. Asking my permission first, Yamin proceeded to select an assortment from the various trays. Then he turned back to me. "A question for you, Mr. Perkins, if I might be so bold. What destroyed the cultures of your own native peoples, the Indians?" I responded that I felt there had been many factors, including greed and superior weapons. "Yes, true, all of that. But more than anything else, did it not come down to a destruction of the environment?" He went on to explain how, once forests and animals such as the buffalo are destroyed, and once people are moved onto reservations, the very foundations of cultures collapse. "You see, it is the same here," he said. "The desert is our environment. The Flowering Desert Project threatens nothing less than the destruction of our entire fabric. How can we allow this to happen? I told him that it was my understanding that the whole idea behind the project came from his people. He responded with a cynical laugh, saying that the idea was planted in the Shah's mind by my own U.S. government, and that the Shah was just a puppet of that government. A true Persian would never permit such a thing, Yamin said. Then he launched into a long dissertation about the relationship between his people, the Bedouin, and the desert. He emphasized that many urbanized Iranians take their vacations in the desert. They set up tents large enough for the entire family and spend a week or more living in them. We, my people, are part of the desert. The people the Shah claimed to rule with that iron hand of his are not just of the desert. We are the desert. After that, he told me stories about his personal experiences in the desert. When the evening was over, he escorted me back to the tiny door in the large wall. My taxi was waiting in the street outside. Yamin shook my hand and expressed his appreciation for the time I had spent with him. He again mentioned my young age and my openness, and the fact that my occupying such a position gave him hope for the future. I am so glad to have had this time with a man like you. He continued to hold my hand in his. I would request of you only one more favor. I do not ask this lightly. I do it only because after our time together tonight, I know it will be meaningful to you. You'll gain a great deal from it. What is it I can do for you? I would like to introduce you to a dear friend of mine, a man who can tell you a great deal about our King of Kings. He may shock you, but I assure you that meeting him will be well worth your time. Chapter 19. Confessions of a Tortured Man. Several days later, Yamin drove me out of Tehran, through a dusty and impoverished shantytown, along an old camel trail, and out to the edge of the desert. With the sun setting behind the city, he stopped his car at a cluster of tiny mud shacks surrounded by palm trees. A very old oasis, he explained, dating back centuries before Marco Polo. He preceded me to one of the shacks. The man inside has a PhD from one of your most prestigious universities. For reasons that will soon be clear, he must remain nameless. You can call him Doc. He knocked on the wooden door, and there was a muffled response. Yamin pushed the door open and led me inside. The tiny room was windowless and lit only by an oil lamp on a low table in one corner. As my eyes adjusted, I saw the dirt floor was covered with Persian carpets. Then the shadowy outline of a man began to emerge. He was seated in front of the lamp in a way that kept his features hidden. I could tell only that he was bundled in blankets and was wearing something around his head. He sat in a wheelchair, and other than the table, this was the only piece of furniture in the room. Yamin motioned for me to sit on a carpet. He approached and gently embraced the man, speaking a few words in his ear, then returned and sat at my side. I've told you about Mr. Perkins, he said. We're both honored to have this opportunity to visit with you, sir. Mr. Perkins, you are welcome. The voice, with barely any detectable accent, was low and hoarse. I found myself leaning forward into the small space between us as he said, You see before you a broken man. I have not always been so. Once I was strong like you. I was a close and trusted advisor to the Shah. There was a long pause. The Shah of Shahs. King of Kings. His tone of voice sounded, I thought, more sad than angry. I personally knew many of the world's leaders. Eisenhower, Nixon, de Gaulle. They trusted me to help lead this country into the capitalist camp. The Shah trusted me, and he made a sound that could have been a cough, but which I took for a laugh. I trusted the Shah. I believed his rhetoric. I was convinced that Iran would lead the Muslim world into a new epoch, that Persia would fulfill its promise. It seemed our destiny, the Shah's, mine, all of ours who carried out the mission we thought we had been born to fulfill. The lump of blankets moved. The wheelchair made a wheezing noise and turned slightly. I could see the outline of the man's face in profile, his shaggy beard, and then it grabbed me. The flatness. He had no nose. I shuddered and stifled a gasp. "Not a pretty sight, would you say, huh, Mr. Perkins? Too bad you can't see it in full light. It is truly grotesque." Again, there was the sound of choking laughter. "But as I'm sure you can appreciate, I must remain anonymous. Certainly you could learn my identity if you tried, although you might find that I am dead. Officially, I no longer exist. Yet I trust you won't try. You and your family are better off not knowing who I am. The arm of the Shah and Savak reaches far." The chair wheezed and returned to its original position. I felt a sense of relief, as though not seeing the profile somehow obliterated the violence that had been done. At the time, I did not know of this custom among some Islamic cultures. Individuals deemed to have brought dishonor or disgrace upon society or its leaders are punished by having their noses cut off. In this way, they are marked for life, as this man's face clearly demonstrated. "I'm sure, Mr. Perkins, you are wondering why we invited you here." Without waiting for my response, the man in the wheelchair continued, "You see, this man who calls himself the King of Kings is in reality satanic. His father was deposed by your CIA with, I hate to say it, my help, because he was said to be a Nazi collaborator. And then there was the Mossadegh calamity. Today our Shah is on the route to surpassing Hitler in the realms of evil. He does this with the full knowledge and support of your government." "Why is that?" I asked. "Quite simple. He is your only real ally in the Middle East, and the industrial world rotates on the axle of oil that is the Middle East. Oh, you have Israel, of course, but that's actually a liability to you, not an asset. And no oil there. Your politicians must placate the Jewish vote, must get their money to finance campaigns. So you're stuck with Israel, I'm afraid. However, Iran is the key. Your oil companies, which carry even more power than the Jews, need us. You need our Shah, or you think you do, just as you thought you needed South Vietnam's corrupt leaders. Are you suggesting otherwise? Is Iran the equivalent to Vietnam? Potentially much worse. You see, this Shah won't last much longer. The Muslim world hates him. Not just the Arabs, but Muslims everywhere. Indonesia, the United States, but mostly right here, his own Persian people. There was a thumping sound, and I realized that he had struck the side of his chair. "He is evil. We Persians hate him." Then silence. I could hear only his heavy breathing, as though the exertion had exhausted him. "Doc is very close to the mullahs," Yamin said to me, his voice low and calm. "There is a huge undercurrent among the religious factions here, and it pervades most of our country, except for a handful of people in the commercial classes who benefit from the Shah's capitalism." "I don't doubt you," I said. "But I must say that during 4 visits here, I've seen nothing of it. Everyone I talk with seems to love the Shah, to appreciate the economic upsurge." "You don't speak Farsi," Yamin observed. "You hear only what is told to you by those men who benefit the most. The ones who have been educated in the States or in England end up working for the Shah. Doc here is an exception. Now," he paused, seeming to ponder his next words. "It's the same with your press. They only talk with the few who are his kin, his circle. Of course, for the most part, your press is also controlled by oil. So they hear what they want to hear and write what their advertisers want to read." "Why are we telling you all this, Mr. Perkins?" Doc's voice was even more hoarse than before, as if the effort of speaking and the emotions were draining what little energy the man had mustered for this meeting. "Because we'd like to convince you to get out, and to persuade your company to stay away from our country. We want to warn you that although you may think you'll make a great deal of money here, it's an illusion. This government will not last." Again, I heard the sound of his hand thudding against the chair. And when it goes, the one that replaces it will have no sympathy for you and your kind. You're saying we won't be paid? Doc broke down in a fit of coughing. Yamin went to him and rubbed his back. When the coughing ended, he spoke to Doc in Farsi, and then came back to his seat. We must end this conversation, Yamin said to me. In answer to your question, yes, you will not be paid. You'll do all that work, and when it comes time to collect your fees, the Shah will be gone. During the drive back, I asked Yamin why he and Doc wanted to spare Maine the financial disaster he had predicted. We'd be happy to see your company go bankrupt. However, we'd rather see you leave Iran. Just one company like yours, walking away, could start a trend. That's what we're hoping. You see, we don't want a bloodbath here, but the Shah must go, and we'll try anything that will make that easier. So we pray to Allah that you'll convince your Mr. Zambadi to get out while there is still time. Why me? I knew during our dinner together, when we spoke of the Flowering Desert Project, that you were open to the truth. I knew that our information about you was correct. You are a man between two worlds, a man in the middle. It made me wonder just how much he did know about me. Chapter 20, The Fall of a King. One evening in 1978, while I was sitting alone at the luxurious bar off the lobby of the Hotel Intercontinental in Tehran, I felt a tap on my shoulder. I turned to see a heavy-set Iranian in a business suit.
John Perkins! You don't remember me?
The former soccer player had gained a lot of weight, but the voice was unmistakable. It was my old Middlebury friend, Farad, whom I had not seen in more than a decade. We embraced and sat down together. It quickly became obvious that he knew all about me and my work. It was equally obvious that he did not intend to share much about his own work. He told me that something dangerous was about to happen, and that it was his responsibility to see to it that I left the country. At that point, I figured Farad worked for the CIA or some other U.S. agency.
Let's get right to the point, he said. I'm flying to Rome tomorrow. My parents live there. I have a ticket for you on my flight.
He handed me an airline ticket. I did not doubt him for a moment. I had a job to do, but by now I figured part of that meant staying out of trouble, and staying alive. In Rome, we dined with Farad's parents. His father, the retired Iranian general who once stepped in front of a would-be assassin's bullet to save the Shah's life, expressed disillusionment with his former boss. He said that during the past few years the Shah had shown his true colors, his arrogance and greed. The general blamed U.S. policy, particularly its backing of Israel, of corrupt leaders, and of despotic governments, for the hatred sweeping the Middle East. And he predicted that the Shah would be gone within months.
You know, he said, you sowed the seeds of this rebellion in the early 50s, when you overthrew Mossadegh. You thought it very clever back then, as did I. But now it returns to haunt you, us.
I was astounded by his pronouncements. I had heard something similar from Yamin and Doc, but coming from this man, it took on new significance. By this time, everyone knew of the existence of a fundamentalist Islamic underground, but we had convinced ourselves that the Shah was immensely popular among the majority of his people and was therefore politically invincible. The general, however, was adamant. Mark my words, he said solemnly. The Shah's fall will be only the beginning. It's a preview of where the Muslim world is headed. Our rage has smoldered beneath the sands too long. Soon it will erupt. Over dinner, I heard a great deal about Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Farad and his father made it clear that they did not support his fanatical Shiism, but they were obviously impressed by the inroads he had made against the Shah. They told me that this cleric, whose given name translated to inspired of God, was born into a family of dedicated Shiite scholars in a village near Tehran in 1902. Khomeini made it a point not to become involved in the Mossadegh-Shah struggles of the early 1950s, but he actively opposed the Shah in the 1960s, criticizing the ruler so adamantly that Khomeini was banished to Turkey,
then to the Shiite holy city of An-Najaf in Iraq, where he became the acknowledged leader of the opposition. He sent out letters, articles, and tape-recorded messages urging Iranians to rise up, overthrow the Shah, and create a clerical state. 2 days after that dinner with Farhad and his parents, news came out of Iran of bombings and riots. Ayatollah Khomeini and the mullahs had begun the offensive that would soon give them control. After that, things happened fast. The rage that Farhad's father had described exploded in a violent Islamic uprising. The Shah fled his country for Egypt in January 1979, and then, diagnosed with cancer, headed for a New York hospital. Followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini demanded his return. In November 1979, a militant Islamic mob seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held 52 American hostages for the next 444 days. President Carter attempted to negotiate the release of the hostages. When this failed, he authorized a military rescue mission, launched in April 1980. It was a disaster, and it turned out to be the hammer that would drive the final nail into Carter's presidential coffin. Tremendous pressure, exerted by U.S. commercial and political groups, forced the cancer-ridden Shah to leave the United States. From the day he fled Tehran, he had a difficult time finding sanctuary. All his former friends shunned him. However, General Torrijos exhibited his customary compassion and offered the Shah asylum in Panama, despite a personal dislike of the Shah's politics. The Shah arrived and received sanctuary at the same resort where the new Panama Canal Treaty had so recently been negotiated. The mullahs demanded the Shah's return in exchange for the hostages held in the U.S. Embassy. Those in Washington who had opposed the Canal Treaty accused Torrijos of corruption and collusion with the Shah, and of endangering the lives of U.S. citizens. They, too, demanded that the Shah be turned over to Ayatollah Khomeini. Ironically, until only a few weeks earlier, many of these same people had been the Shah's staunchest supporters. The once proud King of Kings eventually returned to Egypt, where he died of cancer. Doc's prediction came true. Maine lost millions of dollars in Iran, as did many of our competitors. Carter lost his bid for re-election. The Reagan-Bush administration marched into Washington with promises to free the hostages, to bring down the mullahs, to return democracy to Iran, and to set straight the Panama Canal situation. For me, the lessons were irrefutable. Iran illustrated beyond any doubt that the United States was a nation laboring to deny the truth of its role in the world. It seemed incomprehensible that we could have been so misinformed about the Shah and the tide of hatred that had surged against him. Even those of us in companies like Maine, which had offices and personnel in the country, had not known. I felt certain that the NSA and the CIA must have seen what had been so obvious to Torrijos even as far back as my meeting with him in 1972, but that our own intelligence community had intentionally encouraged us all to close our eyes. Chapter 21. Colombia, Keystone of Latin America. Although Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Panama offered fascinating and disturbing studies, they also stood out as exceptions to the rule. Due to vast oil deposits in the first two, and the canal in the third, they did not fit the norm. Colombia's situation was more typical, and Maine was the designer and lead engineering firm on a huge hydroelectric project there. A Colombian college professor writing a book on the history of Pan-American relations once told me that Teddy Roosevelt had appreciated the significance of his country. Pointing at a map, the U.S. president and former Rough Rider reportedly described Colombia as the keystone to the arch of South America. I have never verified that story. However, it is certainly true that on a map, Colombia, poised at the top of the continent, appears to hold the rest of the continent together. It connects all the southern countries to the Isthmus of Panama, and therefore to both Central and North America. Whether Roosevelt actually described Colombia in those terms or not, he was only one of many presidents who understood its pivotal position. For nearly two centuries, the United States has viewed Colombia as a keystone, or perhaps more accurately, as a portal into the southern hemisphere for both business and politics. The country also is endowed with great natural beauty, spectacular palm-lined beaches on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, majestic mountains, pampas that rival the great plains of the North American Midwest, and vast rainforests rich in biodiversity. The people, too, have a special quality, combining the physical, cultural, and artistic traits of diverse ethnic backgrounds, ranging from the local Tairona to imports from Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Historically, Colombia has played a crucial role in Latin American history and culture. During the colonial period, Colombia was the seat of the viceroy for all Spanish territories north of Peru and south of Costa Rica. The great fleets of gold galleons set sail from its coastal city of Cartagena to transport priceless treasures from as far south as Chile and Argentina to ports in Spain. Many of the critical actions in the wars for independence occurred in Colombia. For example, forces under Simón Bolívar were victorious over Spanish royalists at the pivotal Battle of Boyacá in 1819. In modern times, Colombia has had a reputation for producing some of Latin America's most brilliant writers, artists, philosophers, and other intellectuals, as well as fiscally responsible and relatively democratic governments. It became the model for President Kennedy's nation-building programs throughout Latin America. Unlike Guatemala's, its government was not tarnished with the reputation of being a CIA creation, and unlike Nicaragua's, the government was an elected one, which presented an alternative to both right-wing dictators and communists. Finally, unlike so many other countries, including powerful Brazil and Argentina, Colombia did not mistrust the United States. The image of Colombia as a reliable ally has continued, despite the blemish of its drug cartels. The glories of Colombia's history, however, are counterbalanced by hatred and violence. The seat of the Spanish viceroy was also home to the Inquisition. Magnificent forts, haciendas, and cities were constructed over the bones of Indian and African slaves. The treasures carried on the gold galleons, sacred objects and masterpieces of art that had been melted down for easy transport, were ripped from the hearts of ancient peoples. The proud cultures themselves were laid to waste by conquistador swords and diseases. More recently, a controversial presidential election in 1945 resulted in a deep division between political parties and led to La Violencia, 1948 to 1957, during which more than 200,000 people died. Despite the conflicts and ironies, both Washington and Wall Street historically have viewed Colombia as an essential factor in promoting Pan-American political and commercial interests. This is due to several factors, in addition to Colombia's critical geographic location, including the perception that leaders throughout the hemisphere look to Bogotá for inspiration and guidance, and the fact that the country is both a source of many products purchased in the United States: coffee, bananas, textiles, emeralds, flowers, oil, and cocaine, and a market for our goods and services. One of the most important services we sold to Colombia during the late 20th century was engineering and construction expertise. Colombia was typical of many places where I worked. It was relatively easy to demonstrate that the country could assume vast amounts of debt and then repay these debts from the benefits realized from the projects themselves and from the country's natural resources. Thus, huge investments in electrical power grids, highways, and telecommunications would help Colombia open up its vast gas and oil resources and its largely undeveloped Amazonian territories. These projects, in turn, would generate the income necessary to pay off the loans, plus interest. That was the theory. However, the reality, consistent with our true intent around the world, was to subjugate Bogotá to further the global empire. My job, as it had been in so many places, was to present the case for exceedingly large loans. Colombia did not have the benefit of a Torrijos. Therefore, I felt I had no choice but to develop inflated economic and electric load forecasts. With the exception of the occasional bouts of guilt over my job, Colombia became a personal refuge for me. Ann and I had spent a couple of months there in the early 1970s, and had even made a down payment on a small coffee farm located in the mountains along the Caribbean coast. I think our time together during that period came as close as anything could to healing the wounds I had inflicted on her over the preceding years. Ultimately, however, the wounds went too deep,
and it was not until after our marriage fell apart that I became truly acquainted with the country. During the 1970s, Maine had been awarded a number of contracts to develop various infrastructure projects, including a network of hydroelectric facilities and the distribution systems to transport the electricity from deep in the jungle to cities high in the mountains. I was given an office in the coastal city of Barranquilla, and it was there, in 1977, that I met a beautiful Colombian woman who had become a powerful agent of change in my life. Paula was a political activist with long blonde hair and striking green eyes, not what most foreigners expect in a Colombian. Her mother and father had emigrated from northern Italy, and in keeping with her heritage, she became a fashion designer. She went a step further, however, and built a small factory where her creations were transformed into clothes, which she then sold at upscale boutiques throughout the country, as well as in Panama and Venezuela. She was a deeply compassionate person who helped me get through some of the personal trauma of my broken marriage and begin dealing with some of my attitudes toward women, which had affected me so negatively. She also taught me a great deal about the consequences of the actions I took in my job. As I've said before, life is composed of a series of coincidences over which we have no control. For me, those included being raised as the son of a teacher at an all-male prep school in rural New Hampshire, meeting Anne and her Uncle Frank, the Vietnam War, and meeting Einar Grieve. However, once we are presented with such coincidences, we face choices. How we respond, the actions we take in the face of coincidences, makes all the difference. For example, excelling at that school, marrying Anne, entering the Peace Corps, and choosing to become an economic hitman, all these decisions had brought me to my current place in life. Paula was another coincidence, and her influence would lead me to take actions that changed the course of my life. Until I met her, I had pretty much gone along with the system. I often found myself questioning what I was doing, sometimes feeling guilty about it. Yet I always discovered a way to rationalize staying in the system. Perhaps Paula just happened along at the right time. It is possible that I would have taken the plunge anyway, that my experiences in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Panama would have nudged me into action. But I am certain that even as one woman, Claudine, had been instrumental in persuading me to join the ranks of EHMs, another, Paula, was the catalyst I needed at that time. She convinced me to go deep inside myself and see that I would never be happy as long as I continued in that role. Chapter 22. American Republic versus Global Empire. "I'll be frank," Paula said one day while we were sitting in a coffee shop. "The Indians and all the farmers who live along the river you're damming hate you. Even people in the cities who aren't directly affected sympathize with the guerrillas who've been attacking your construction camp. Your government calls these people communists, terrorists, and narcotics traffickers. But the truth is they're just people with families who live on lands your company is destroying." I had just told her about Manuel Torres. He was an engineer employed by Maine and one of the men recently attacked by guerrillas at our hydroelectric dam construction site. Manuel was a Colombian citizen who had a job because of a U.S. Department of State rule prohibiting us from sending U.S. citizens to that site. We referred to it as the Colombians are expendable doctrine, and it symbolized an attitude I had grown to hate. My feelings toward such policies were making it increasingly difficult for me to live with myself. "According to Manuel, they fired AK-47s into the air and at his feet," I told Paula. "He sounded calm when he told me about it, but I know he was almost hysterical. They didn't shoot anyone, just gave them that letter and sent them downriver in their boats." "My God," Paula exclaimed. "The poor man must have been terrified." "Of course he was." I told her that I had asked Manuel whether he thought they were FARC or M19, referring to two of the most infamous Colombian guerrilla groups. "And?" "He said neither. But he told me that he believes what they said in that letter." Paula picked up the newspaper I had brought and read the letter aloud. "We, who work every day just to survive, swear on the blood of our ancestors that we will never allow dams across our rivers. We are simple Indians and mestizos, but we would rather die than stand by as our land is flooded. We warn our Colombian brothers, stop working for the construction companies. She set the paper down.
What did you say to him?
I hesitated, but only for a moment. I had no choice. I had to toe the company line. I asked him if he thought that sounds like a letter a farmer would write. She sat watching me patiently. He just shrugged. Our eyes met. Oh, Paula, I detest myself for playing this role.
What did you do next?
She pressed. I slammed my fist on the desk. I intimidated him. I asked him whether farmers with AK-47s made any sense to him. Then I asked if he knew who invented the AK-47.
Did he?
Yes, but I could hardly hear his answer. A Russian, he said. Of course, I assured him that he was right, that the inventor had been a communist named Kalashnikov, a highly decorated officer in the Red Army. I brought him around to understand that the people who wrote that note were communists.
Do you believe that?
She asked.
Her question stopped me. How could I answer honestly?
I recalled Iran and the time Yamin described me as a man caught between two worlds, a man in the middle. In some ways, I wished I had been in that camp when the guerrillas attacked, or that I was one of the guerrillas. An odd feeling crept over me, a sort of jealousy for Yamin and Doc and the Colombian rebels. These were men with convictions. They had chosen real worlds, not a no-man's territory somewhere between.
I have a job to do, I said at last.
She smiled gently. I hate it, I continued. I thought about the men whose images had come to me so often over the years, Tom Paine and other Revolutionary War heroes, pirates and frontiersmen. They stood at the edges, not in the middle. They took stands and lived with the consequences. Every day I come to hate my job a little more. She took my hand.
Your job?
Our eyes met and held. I understood the implication.
Myself.
She squeezed my hand and nodded slowly. I felt an immediate sense of relief, just admitting it.
What will you do, John?
I had no answer. The relief turned into defensiveness. I stammered out the standard justifications, that I was trying to do good, that I was exploring ways to change the system from within, and, the old standby, that if I quit, someone even worse would fill my shoes. But I could see from the way she watched me that she was not buying it. Even worse, I knew that I was not buying it either. She had forced me to understand the essential truth. It was not my job, but me, that was to blame.
What about you?
I asked at last.
What do you believe?
She gave a little sigh and released my hand, asking,
You trying to change the subject?
I nodded.
Okay,
she agreed. Under one condition, that we'll return to it another day. She picked up a spoon and appeared to examine it. I know that some of the guerrillas have trained in Russia and China. She lowered the spoon into her cafe con leche, stirred, and then slowly licked the spoon.
What else can they do?
They need to learn about modern weapons and how to fight the soldiers who've gone through your schools. Sometimes they sell cocaine in order to raise money for supplies. How else can they buy guns? They're up against terrible odds. Your World Bank doesn't help them defend themselves. In fact, it forces them into this position. She took a sip of coffee. I believe their cause is just. The electricity will help only a few, the wealthiest Colombians, and thousands will die because the fish and water are poisoned after you build that dam of yours. Hearing her speak so compassionately about the people who opposed us, me, caused my flesh to crawl. I found myself clawing at my forearms. How do you know so much about the guerrillas? Even as I asked it, I had a sinking feeling. A premonition that I did not want to know the answer. I went to school with one of them, she said. She hesitated, pushed her cup away. My brother joined the movement. There it was. I felt absolutely deflated. I thought I knew all about her, but this? I had the fleeting image of a man coming home to find his wife in bed with another man.
How come you never told me?
Seemed irrelevant. Why would I? It isn't something I brag about. She paused.
I haven't seen him for 2 years. He has to be very careful.
How do you know he's alive?
I don't. Except recently the government put him on a wanted list. That's a good sign.
I was fighting the urge to be judgmental or defensive. I hoped she could not discern my jealousy.
How did he become one of them?
I asked. Fortunately, she kept her eyes on the coffee cup.
Demonstrating outside the offices of an oil company? Occidental, I think. He was protesting drilling on indigenous lands, in the forests of a tribe facing extinction, him and a couple dozen of his friends. They were attacked by the army, beaten, and thrown into prison. For doing nothing illegal, mind you, just standing outside that building waving placards and singing.
She glanced out a nearby window.
They kept him in jail for nearly 6 months. He never did tell us what happened there. But when he came out, he was a different person.
It was the first of many similar conversations with Paula, and I now know that these discussions set the stage for what was to follow. My soul was torn apart, and yet I was still ruled by my wallet and by those other weaknesses the NSA had identified when they profiled me a decade earlier in 1968. By forcing me to see this and to confront the deeper feelings behind my fascination with pirates and other rebels, Paula helped me along the trail toward salvation. Beyond my own personal dilemmas, my times in Colombia also helped me comprehend the distinction between the ideals behind the old American Republic and those of the new global empire. The Republic offered hope to the world. Its foundation was moral and philosophical rather than materialistic. It was based on concepts of equality and justice for all. But it also could be pragmatic, not merely a utopian dream, but also a living, breathing entity. It could make big mistakes, like denying non-landowners, women, and minorities the right to vote for more than a century. It could open its arms to shelter the downtrodden, then force their children to work under slave-like conditions in its factories. It could be an inspiration, and at the same time, a force to reckon with. If needed, it could swing into action, as it had during World War II, to defend the principles for which it stood. The very institutions, the big corporations, banks, and government bureaucracies that have threatened those ideals could instead be redirected to institute fundamental changes in the world. At least in theory. Such institutions possess the communications networks and transportation systems necessary to end disease, starvation, and even wars, if only they could be convinced to take that course. The global empire, on the other hand, is the Republic's nemesis. It is self-centered, self-serving, greedy, and materialistic, a system based on mercantilism. Like earlier empires, it opens its arms only to accumulate resources, to grab everything in sight and stuff its insatiable maw. It will do whatever is needed to help its rulers gain more power and riches. Of course, in learning to understand this distinction, I also developed a clearer sense of my own role. Claudine had warned me. She had honestly outlined what would be expected of me if I accepted the job Maine offered. Yet it took the experience of working in countries like Indonesia, Panama, Iran, and Colombia in order for me to face the deeper implications. And it took the patience, love, and personal stories of a person like Paula. I was loyal to the American Republic, but what we were perpetrating through this new, highly subtle form of imperialism was the financial equivalent of what we had attempted to accomplish militarily in Vietnam. If Southeast Asia had taught us that armies have limitations, the economists had responded by devising a better plan, and the foreign aid agencies and the private contractors who served them, or, more appropriately, were served by them, had become proficient at executing that plan. In countries on every continent, I saw how many men and women working for U.S. corporations, though not officially part of the EHM network, participated in something far more pernicious than anything envisioned in conspiracy theories. They would do whatever they thought it would take, or were told it would take, to perpetuate the system we EHMs advocated. Like many of Maine's engineers, these workers were blind to the consequences of their actions, convinced that the sweatshops and factories that made shoes and automotive parts for their companies
were helping the poor climb out of poverty, instead of simply burying them deeper in a type of slavery reminiscent of medieval manors and southern plantations. As in those earlier manifestations of exploitation, modern serfs or slaves were socialized into believing they were better off than the unfortunate souls who lived on the margins, in the dark hollows of Europe.